Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Jean-Paul Sartre, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 5.
Jean-Paul Sartre was fascinated by human relationships, especially those which are difficult and conflicted. He was struck by the power of relationships and what happens in them to shape everyone's view of himself. Among other things, Sartre was drawing on his own experience. Sartre's father had died when Jean-Paul was but a year old, so he'd learned how the deepest human connections could be painfully disrupted. He'd naturally turned his devotion to his mother. But after 12 years of living closely with her in her parents' home, she remarried and began a new home in which Sartre never felt welcome. Disruption again. Sartre tells us that during his childhood he became aware of his power to please others, and he also discovered their power over him. He was to develop his power to please. He became quite easy and popular with a wide variety of people. But Sartre learned to guard himself against the power of others. He had only a few close friends. In the most intimate relationships of later life, in particular in his lifelong devotion to the writer Simone de Beauvoir, Sartre required, as did she, that each of them recognize the freedom and independence of the other. Sartre seems to have concluded that, even at their best, human relationships put each of us at risk. It should be no surprise, then, that certain themes run through Sartre's literary and philosophical treatment of personal relations. These themes are contingency, conflict, and the conviction that one person always threatens the self-definition and freedom of another. Indeed, Sartre comes to see the human condition generally in terms of these themes. To be a human being, in a sense, is to be cut off from others, against them, and vulnerable to them. Sartre calls this our being for others. To understand what he means by this expression, being for others, we have to remember Sartre's notion of the for itself. We've already seen that for Sartre, human reality is for itself. Each of us inhabits a world which is meaningful for us. We have our perspective on things, we orient ourselves to things, we see, feel, desire, act in the world in ways that relate to each of us individually. And each of us is conscious of being this distinctive perspective on things. Sartre thinks each of us is a being for itself, or alternatively, a being for myself. But each of us has to recognize that we're more than that. We're in a world among other people, so we are for others too. You are a being for others. There's an aspect of your being, a dimension of what you inevitably are, which is not for you. To use the language of nothingness, once again, we are what we are not, in this case, other people. How do I experience this being for others? Most basically, when I sense myself in the presence of another person. Suppose, says Sartre, that I'm in a public park. Not far away, there's a lawn. Along the edge of the lawn, there are benches. Now, a man passes those benches, and I see him look out at the lawn. I see him see me, too. All of a sudden, I experience my world, the park, the lawn, the benches, in a new way. It's now his world, too. My world seems to disintegrate and reorganize itself around this intruder.
There is a total space which is grouped around the other, and this space is made with my space. There is a regrouping in which I participate, but which escapes me. A regrouping of all the objects which people my universe. This regrouping does not stop there. The grass is something differently qualified. It is this green grass which exists for the other. In this sense, the very quality of the object, its deep, raw green, is in direct relation to this man. This green turns toward the other, an aspect which escapes me. I apprehend the relation of the green to the other as an objective relation, but I cannot apprehend the green as it appears to the other. Thus, suddenly, an object has appeared which has stolen the world from me.
My world, in short, is experienced differently when it's experienced not only for me, but also for another. And that man over there, when I experience him as a man, is experienced as an object radically different from other objects. He's an object which has a world for him. His world is for him in a way which inevitably escapes me. I may take the man as an object in my world, and in this way I revenge myself on him. But while he's there, my world has become an object for him.
It appears that the world has a kind of drain hole in the middle of its being, and that it is perpetually flowing off through this hole.
But not only is my world affected, I'm affected too. I become an object in his world, organized around him. When I see him see me, I'm conscious of being looked at. I too am being reorganized, and in a way which escapes me. Here the threat to my being emerges. I am, like it or not, vulnerable. I have a body that can be seen. I am seen. I am in my being, not only for myself, but for him. Sartre elaborates this point by describing yet another situation.
Let us imagine that, moved by jealousy, curiosity, or vice, I have just glued my ear to the door and looked through a keyhole. I'm alone.
In such a position, Sartre's world is entirely his, and he is completely engaged with it. In a sense, Sartre is not an I, a self, at all. Sartre is in no way self-conscious. He's entirely caught up with the scene laid out before him through that keyhole. One could say his attitude has no outside at all. It's a pure process of relating to the spectacle. And his projects organize everything he sees. His jealousy, for instance, informs everything.
But suddenly, I hear footsteps in the hall. Someone is looking at me. What does this mean? It means that I am suddenly affected in my very being.
In the first place, Sartre has become a self in a distinctive sense. Not in the way he would be if he simply thought about his present jealous spying. He could do that by himself and entirely for himself. Now, however, he exists not simply for himself, but for others, as a person who is an object for another. Sartre now has an outside. Sartre is a body, an object in a certain objective place, doing certain objective things. This is the power of others, that they make us be something we cannot escape dealing with, something we cannot escape being. But it's something beyond our own being for ourselves, and it places us at the disposal of the other.
Everything takes place as if I had a dimension of being from which I was separated by a radical nothingness. And this nothingness is the other's freedom.
Since he's being looked at by another person, Sartre is what the other takes him to be. He becomes a peeping Tom, a dangerous eccentric, perhaps a mere curiosity or a matter of no interest at all, depending on the other's objectification of him. Sartre describes this experience as a kind of fall. Much as with the biblical fall from grace, he senses in it a kind of shame. The shame in this case comes when we're taken out of our pure and perfect interior existence and exposed to the view of another. And because of this, we are no longer masters of the situation. Our inmost possibilities of action get reoriented around this other person as well. So, says Sartre, the instrumentalities of things around us change.
My relation to an object, or the potentiality of an object, decomposes under the other's look and appears to me as my possibility of utilizing the object only insofar as it is transcended by the other toward his own possibilities. For example, the potentiality of the dark corner over there becomes a given possibility of hiding in the corner by the sole fact that the other is looking at me and can transcend it toward his possibility of illuminating the corner with his flashlight. This possibility is there, but I only apprehend it through my anguish and through my decision to give up that hiding place which now seems too risky. And then I find this urge to run away, which dominates me and carries me along and which I am. This, too, I read in the other's watchful look, and in that other look, the gun pointed at me.
Sartre finds that his possibilities are suddenly defined not by himself alone, but by the other who is looking at him. What he might do is given new meaning and risk by what the other might do. Through this kind of experience, Sartre thinks, we can see our generic condition as a being in the world among others. In this condition, we must encounter and respond to the conflicting presences and embodied projects of others if we're to give meaning to anything in our world, to any of our possible actions. And so we're always in an unpredictable, unstable position. But we have to be careful here. Sartre's not saying that we're always fighting with others in some overt way. We're not always jealous. We're not always at keyholes. Others are not always finding us out, pointing guns at us. We may be friendly and peaceable, we may even love one another. But, Sartre claims, all human relations are afflicted to some extent with the instability and unpredictability of the human condition. In the most intimate relations, in sexual love perhaps especially, conflict is going to be present. Each partner will always seek to possess and control the other, if by nothing else than favors given and received. The relationship will be essentially unpredictable, requiring continual negotiation. In any relationship, when we say we, or when we act as if we form a community with others, there's always likely to be some conflict that's masked, because we're irreducibly different selves, and because in human relations our freedom is always at issue, there is going to be conflict.
Conflict is the original meaning of being for others.
The best thing to do, then, is to recognize the reality of conflict. We have to accept it, take account of it, and we have to be on our guard. Sartre dramatically portrays some dimensions of our being for others in his early play, No Exit, produced during World War II. In it, three people find themselves in hell and have to confront one another. But hell's very different from their expectations. It's simply a room, to be sure, a rather warm room, in which they're condemned to be with one another for eternity. As one of them, Garcin, concludes at the end of the play,
"So this is hell. I'd never have believed it. You remember all we were told about the torture chambers, the fire and brimstone, the burning marl? Old wives' tales. There's no need for red-hot pokers. Hell is other people."
We get some background for this observation from the early interactions of the characters. There is first Inez, a woman who has the capacity, as she puts it, to get under people's skin. She then takes delight in destroying them. The second woman, Estelle, is a beauty. She's conscious of her beauty, but she depends on others to recognize it. And finally, there's Garcin, a political journalist who's been building an image of himself as a courageous crusader for years. All these characters have dark secrets which are disclosed during the play, each exposed in the presence of the others. Each is in conflict with the others, and each is shown to be dependent on the others for his or her very being. In the following scene, we can get a bit of Sartre's sense for both the painful and the comic aspects of our vulnerability to others.
"Wait. You'll see how simple it is. Childishly simple. There isn't any physical torture, and yet we're in hell, and no one else will come here. We'll stay in this room together, the three of us, forever and ever. In short, there's someone missing here. The official torturer."
"I noticed that."
"It's obvious they're economizing on manpower. The same idea as in a cafeteria, where the customers serve themselves."
"What are you getting at?"
"I mean that each of us will act as a torturer for the other two."
"Pardon, sir, have you a mirror? Any sort of glass, a pocket mirror will do. Even if you won't speak to me, you might lend me a mirror."
"Don't worry, I've a mirror in my bag." "It's gone. They must have taken it at the entrance."
"How tiresome. Oh.
What's the matter?
I feel so queer. Oh, don't you ever feel that way, too? When I can't see myself, I begin to wonder if I really exist. I pat myself just to make sure, but it doesn't help.
You're well off. I always feel conscious of myself. It's a feeling in my mind.
Yes, in one's mind. But everything that goes on in one's head is so vague, it puts me to sleep. I've 6 huge looking glasses in my bedroom. I can see them, but they don't see me. They reflect the couch, the carpet, the window. But how empty it is. A mirror where I am not. When I used to talk with people, I always made sure there was one nearby in which I could look at myself. I talked. I saw myself talking. I saw myself as others saw me. That kept me awake. My lipstick. I'm sure I've put it on crooked. I simply can't do without a looking glass for all eternity.
Suppose I be your looking glass. Come, join me. There's a place for you on my sofa.
Are you sure it looks all right?
You're lovely, Estelle.
But how can I rely upon your taste? Is it my taste? Oh, how tormenting it is, enough to drive one crazy.
But I do have your taste, because I like you so much. Look at me. Carefully. Now give me a smile. I'm not so ugly either. Am I not better than your mirror?
I don't quite know. You scare me. My reflection in mirrors never did that. I was used to it, like something I had tamed. I knew it so well. I'm going to smile, and my smile will sink down into your pupils, and heaven knows what will become of it.
And what keeps you from taming me? Suppose the mirror started telling lies, or suppose I shut my eyes and refused to look at you. What could you do with all that loveliness of yours? Oh, don't be afraid. I can't help looking at you. I shan't look away. And I'll be nice to you. Ever so nice. Only you must be friendly, too.
Do I really attract you?
A lot.
But I'd like him to look at me, too.
Of course. Because he's a man. You're a man, and you've won.
You're crazy, both of you. Don't you see where this will end up? Now shut up. Let's all of us sit down again quietly, close our eyes. Each of us must try to forget the presence of the others.
Forget? How silly can you get? I feel you even in my bones. Your silence shrieks in my ears. You can nail up your mouth, cut your tongue out, but how can that keep you from being there? Can you stop thinking? I hear it, ticking away like an alarm clock, and I know you hear me thinking. And it's all very well slouching on your sofa, but you are everywhere. And every sound comes to me soiled because you've intercepted it on its way. Why, you've stolen even my face from me. You know it, and I don't. And what about Estelle? You've stolen her from me, too. If she and I were alone, do you think she'd dare to treat me as she does?
This is the end of Part 5. Please download Part 6 to continue.